Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're stepping into a virtual microbiology lab.
Yeah.
You sent us some Queen's University course material.
Right.
And we're going to try and distill the most important bits for you. So consider this your cheat sheet to understanding, you know,
the foundations.
Yeah, the foundations of microbiology research.
Absolutely.
It's not just the theory though, right?
Well, it's not.
It's understanding what it actually takes to work in one of these labs.
Yeah.
From handling the biohazards.
Yeah, to culturing and actually quantifying those tiny organisms.
Okay, so let's unpack this.
Sure.
First up, the source material talks about biohazard.
Right.
These aren't just a plot device in sci-fi movies, are they?
Not at all. In a lab setting, we're talking about any biological material that could pose a risk.
Okay.
Whether it's bacteria, viruses, or even fungi.
So it's not as simple as just, you know, covering your mouth when you sneeze.
Definitely not. There's a whole classification system for these risks.
Right.
The source material outlines four risk groups, from risk group one, which is considered low risk to individuals and the community, all the way to risk group four, where the stakes are much higher.
Okay, so how do they illustrate this?
They use some pretty real-world examples. For instance, E. coli, which is commonly used in labs, falls under risk group one.
Right.
Then there's Salmonella, the usual suspect in food poisoning cases. That's risk group two.
Oh, yeah.
Things get a bit more serious with risk group three.
Uh-oh.
Where you find Bacillus anthracis, the bacteria behind anthrax.
Okay.
And then there's the infamous Ebola virus. That puts us in the high-risk territory of risk group four.
Wow. So that's quite a range.
Yeah.
Do these risk groups actually dictate how labs and hospitals operate then?
Absolutely. Oh. The level of safety protocols and containment measures directly corresponds to the risk group of the biohazard being handled.
Okay.
Think of it this way. A lab working with Ebola will have far more stringent safety protocols than a lab working with E. coli.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
It's not just about protecting the people in the lab then, is it?
It's not just about the people in the lab.
No. It's the wider community as well.
The wider community. Exactly.
Okay. So that's the potential dangers.
Right.
Let's move on to a less intimidating topic then.
Sure.
The tools of the trade.
Okay.
The source material dives into the world of micropipettes.
Yes.
And it sounds like these are pretty crucial in a microbiology lab.
They are.
I'm imagining these are not your average kitchen measuring spoons.
You're right. They're definitely not for baking a cake.
Okay, good.
Micropipettes are incredibly precise instruments designed to measure and transfer incredibly small volumes of liquids.
Wow.
Sometimes even just a fraction of a single drop.
So precision is key here.
Precision is key.
We are talking about the microscopic world after all.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
And that's why you need different micropipettes for different volumes.
Okay.
Using the wrong pipette can lead to major inaccuracies in an experiment.
Oh.
The source material even includes a quiz where you have to choose the correct pipette.
Oh.
A P200, a P10, and so on. For specific volumes.
Okay.
It emphasizes that using the wrong tool can really skew your entire experiment.
It's like choosing the right wrench for a bolt then, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, you need the right fit for the job.
You need the right tool for the job.
Okay, so imagine you've mastered the art of the micropipette.
Right.
The next step is learning to culture bacteria.
Yeah.
Which essentially means growing them in a very controlled environment.
A controlled environment, yes.
So this is where it starts to feel like real science is happening.
It does. And here's where the concept of aseptic technique comes into play.
Okay.
This means maintaining a sterile environment to prevent contamination.
Right.
The source material lists several techniques.
Yeah.
Including wiping surfaces with disinfectant, using Bunsen burners for sterilization, and even working within biosafety cabinets for higher risk organisms.
Wow.
Even a tiny speck of contamination can throw off an entire experiment.
So it's like creating a mini super clean room for your bacteria.
Exactly. Speaking of environments, the source material talks about the different types of media or food that bacteria are grown in.
Right.
You have liquid media, which is like a nutrient broth.
Right.
And then there's solid media, which is made by adding agar, a thickening agent,
right,
to create a gel-like surface.
Okay.
This is where those Petri dishes come in handy.
Ah, the Petri dish, a classic symbol of science.
Right. Petri dishes with solid media allow researchers to see those fascinating bacterial colonies develop.
Okay.
The source material actually differentiates between bacterial lawns and isolated colonies.
Okay.
A bacterial lawn is what you get when the Petri dish is crowded with bacteria.
Right.
Whereas isolated colonies are distinct clusters that you can clearly see.
That's a great visual. Why the need for both liquid and solid media, though?
Yeah, it depends on the goal of the research.
Okay.
Liquid media is great for growing large quantities of bacteria.
Okay.
While solid media is essential for isolating specific strains and observing their growth patterns.
So it's all about using the right medium to answer specific research questions then.
Exactly. Okay, so now.
Now here's where things get really interesting.
Oh, good. I like this part.
The source material talks about isolating pure cultures, which is crucial for many experiments.
Right.
Researchers use a technique called streak plating,
okay,
where they carefully spread a bacterial sample across a Petri dish to encourage the growth of isolated colonies.
So you're meticulously creating the perfect spacing for your bacteria to flourish.
Yes. Once you have those isolated colonies,
yeah,
you can then pick a single colony and transfer it to a fresh medium to create a pure culture where all the bacteria are descendants of that one original colony.
So you're creating a microscopic family tree.
You could say that.
Yeah.
And pure cultures are the foundation for a vast amount of research in microbiology.
It's amazing how much precision and patience is involved in this work.
It is.
And that level of precision is also crucial when you need to count those invisible bacteria, right?
So how do you even begin to count something you can't see?
Well, microbiology has some clever techniques for that.
Okay.
The source material focuses on two main methods.
Okay.
Plate counting and turbidimetry.
Okay, let's start with plate counting. Yeah, that has that word.
Remember those isolated colonies we talked about?
Yeah.
With plate counting, you take a known volume of your bacterial culture and spread it on a Petri dish.
Right.
After incubation, you count the colonies that have grown.
Okay.
Each colony theoretically originated from a single bacterium.
Right.
So by counting colonies, you're indirectly counting the bacteria in your original sample.
Okay, but what if you have way too many bacteria to count?
That's a great question.
Wouldn't the Petri dish just be one big blob?
That's where serial dilutions come in.
Okay.
You dilute your sample multiple times, creating a series of less and less concentrated samples.
Okay.
This ensures that at least one of your Petri dishes will have a countable number of colonies, usually between 25 and 250, according to FDA recommendations.
So it's like finding the Goldilocks dilution.
That's not too crowded, not too sparse.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And once you have your countable plate, you can work backward using the dilution factor to calculate the number of bacteria in your original sample.
Clever.
Yeah.
So plate counting seems pretty straightforward.
It is pretty straightforward.
But it does sound a bit time-consuming waiting for those colonies to grow.
That's true. And that's where turbidimetry comes in.
Okay.
It's a much faster method that uses light scattering to estimate bacterial populations.
Okay.
You shine a beam of light through your liquid culture.
Right.
And the more bacteria present, the more the light will be scattered.
So it's like judging the density of fog.
That's a great analogy.
The thicker the fog, the less you can see through it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This scattering is measured using a spectrophotometer, giving you a quick reading on the optical density of your culture, which correlates to the number of bacteria present.
So turbidimetry is all about speed, while plate counting is about precision.
You could say that.
Yeah.
However, there's a catch with turbidimetry.
It can't tell the difference between living and dead bacteria. It just measures the total number of cells present.
Ah, that's an important distinction.
It is.
So each method has its pros and cons depending on the research question.
Precisely. It's all about choosing the right tool for the job.
This has been quite the deep dive already.
Oh, yeah.
We've covered biohazard basics, mastered the art of the micropipette, and learned how to culture and quantify bacteria.
It is.
What an amazing journey into the microscopic world.
It really is. And this is just the beginning of our exploration.
I like it.
Up next, we'll delve into the fascinating world of bacterial growth.
Okay.
And explore how understanding this microscopic phenomenon has real-world implications for fields ranging from food safety to medicine.
Okay. I'm excited.
Me too.
To hear about that.
Yep. Let's do it.
Let's go. Welcome back to our exploration of the microscopic world.
I'm ready for more.
All right. So before we delve any further,
okay,
let's shift our focus to understanding how these tiny but mighty bacteria actually grow. All right. So we've learned how to count them.
Right.
Now let's talk about how they multiply.
Exactly.
What's the key to understanding bacterial growth then?
Well, the first step is understanding that bacteria reproduce very differently from humans.
Okay.
They use a process called binary fission.
Okay.
Where a single bacterium essentially splits into two identical daughter cells.
So it's like a microscopic cloning process?
Exactly.
Cool.
And this process happens at a specific rate known as the generation time.
Okay.
This is the amount of time it takes for a bacterial population to double in size.
So if a bacterium has a generation time of, say, 30 minutes.
Right.
That means every half hour, the population doubles.
Precisely. And this is where it gets really interesting, because each new bacterium can also divide.
Right.
The population doesn't just grow, it explodes.
Yeah.
This is what we call exponential growth.
I'm starting to see how a few bacteria can quickly turn into a whole lot of bacteria.
You got it.
Yeah.
The source material gives a great example using E. coli, which under ideal conditions has a generation time of about 20 minutes.
Wow, that's fast.
They point out that starting with just one E. coli cell, you'd have 8 cells after 1 hour.
Okay.
64 cells after 2 hours.
Thank you.
And a mind-boggling 32,000 cells after just 5 hours.
That's incredible.
It is.
So bacterial growth is definitely not a slow and steady process.
Absolutely not. And to understand this growth pattern in more detail, scientists have broken it down into 4 distinct phases.
Okay.
Lag phase, log phase, stationary phase, and death phase.
Okay, let's break those down. Yeah. What's happening during the lag phase?
Think of the lag phase as the bacteria's adjustment period.
Okay.
They're getting used to their new environment, gathering nutrients, producing enzymes, essentially gearing up for a growth spurt.
So it's like the calm before the storm.
Exactly. Then comes the log phase, or exponential phase, as it's sometimes called.
Right.
This is where that rapid doubling we talked about really takes off.
Yeah.
Bacteria are replicating at their maximum rate, and the population skyrockets.
That's why it's called the exponential phase. It's growth in overdrive.
Precisely. But this rapid growth can't last forever.
Right.
Eventually, the bacteria start to run out of resources,
okay,
space, nutrients, and so on.
Yeah.
The growth rate slows down, and we enter the stationary phase.
Okay.
In this phase, the number of new bacteria being produced is balanced by the number of bacteria dying off.
So it's like reaching a plateau, a point of equilibrium between growth and decline.
Exactly. And finally, as resources become even more limited, the death phase sets in.
Okay.
Now, the rate of bacterial death outpaces the rate of new growth, and the population starts to decline.
So it's a bit like a boom and bust cycle, but on a microscopic scale.
A great analogy. Now, it's important to know that these growth phases are influenced by several factors.
Right.
The source material specifically mentions temperature and aeration as key players.
Right, because not all bacteria thrive in the same conditions.
Exactly.
Some like it hot, some like it cold.
Exactly. When it comes to temperature, bacteria are often classified as mesophiles, psychrophiles, or thermophiles.
Okay.
Mesophiles, like our friend E. coli,
right,
prefer moderate temperatures, typically around 37 degrees Celsius, which is the human body temperature.
Makes sense considering where E. coli is often found.
Precisely. Then you have psychrophiles, the cold-loving bacteria that thrive in chilly environments like refrigerators or even the Arctic.
Whoa.
And on the opposite end of the spectrum are the thermophiles.
Okay.
The heat seekers that can tolerate incredibly high temperatures, sometimes even boiling water.
It's like a Goldilocks situation for temperature.
It is.
Each type of bacteria has its own preference.
Exactly. Now, besides temperature, aeration or the availability of oxygen also plays a crucial role in bacterial growth.
Okay.
Some bacteria like E. coli are obligate aerobes.
Right.
They need oxygen to survive just like we do.
Got it.
Others can't tolerate oxygen at all.
Right.
Those are called obligate anaerobes.
So it's like some bacteria need to breathe while others find oxygen toxic.
That's a great way to think about it. And then you have bacteria that can switch between using oxygen and not using it.
Oh.
Depending on the environment.
Okay.
These are called facultative anaerobes. They're adaptable.
Wow, bacteria are much more diverse than I ever imagined.
They are.
So how do researchers control all these factors, like temperature and aeration, when they're growing bacteria in the lab?
That's a great question. For temperature control, they use incubators,
okay,
which are essentially temperature-controlled chambers that can be set to the ideal temperature for a specific bacterium.
Okay.
And for aeration, researchers often use shaking incubators for liquid cultures.
Right.
This constant shaking helps mix the culture and ensures that oxygen is evenly distributed.
So it's like giving those oxygen-loving bacteria a constant supply of fresh air.
Precisely. And for bacteria that don't need oxygen,
right,
or for whom oxygen is harmful,
yeah,
they might use special chambers that remove or limit oxygen levels.
So creating the right growing conditions is all about mimicking the bacteria's natural habitat as closely as possible.
Exactly. And this careful control of environmental factors is crucial for research, especially when studying things like antibiotic resistance.
Right.
By understanding how bacteria grow best.
Yeah.
Scientists can test how different antibiotics affect their growth and survival.
So we've talked about how bacteria grow and some of the factors that influence their growth.
We have.
I'm really curious about the practical applications of this knowledge, though.
Sure.
You mentioned fields like medicine and food safety.
Yeah.
How does understanding bacterial growth actually make a difference in those areas?
Well, let's start with food safety.
Okay.
Remember those FDA recommendations for plate counting we talked about earlier?
Yeah.
Those are all about making sure that the food we eat doesn't contain dangerous levels of bacteria.
Right. It's not just about making sure my yogurt has enough of those good bacteria.
Exactly.
It's also about making sure there's nothing harmful hiding in there.
Right. Food safety regulations heavily rely on techniques like plate counting to monitor bacterial levels in everything from meat and poultry to dairy products and even prepackaged salads.
Wow.
By understanding how quickly different bacteria can multiply under certain conditions,
right,
scientists can set those sell-by dates and issue warnings about leaving food out at room temperature for too long.
Right. We've all seen those warnings.
Yeah.
But I never really thought about the science behind them.
And it's not just about spoilage either.
Okay.
Understanding bacterial growth is also crucial for preventing the spread of foodborne illnesses.
Right.
For example, knowing that salmonella can double in as little as 30 minutes under the right conditions.
Yeah.
Highlights why it's so important to cook food thoroughly
right.
and practice good hygiene in the kitchen.
It's amazing how something so tiny can have such a big impact on our health.
Absolutely. And speaking of health, let's talk about medicine.
Okay, so we're moving from food poisoning to fighting off infections.
Right.
How does this knowledge translate to that realm?
Well, antibiotics work by targeting specific mechanisms in bacterial growth.
Okay.
Some interfere with cell wall synthesis, preventing bacteria from replicating.
Right.
While others target protein synthesis, essentially shutting down the bacteria's ability to function.
So it's like finding the weak spot in a suit of armor.
Exactly.
You have to know how it's built to find the best place to strike.
That's a great analogy. And knowing about bacterial growth phases helps us understand why timing is so crucial when it comes to antibiotic treatment.
Okay.
Many antibiotics are most effective during the log phase when bacteria are actively dividing and vulnerable.
So taking your antibiotics on schedule as your doctor prescribes is really important.
Exactly. And knowing the generation time of different bacteria helps doctors determine the right dosage and duration of treatment to effectively wipe out the infection.
This is making a lot more sense now.
Good.
But I've also heard a lot about antibiotic resistance.
All right.
And how it's becoming a major global threat. Does understanding bacterial growth play a role in tackling that challenge?
Absolutely.
All right.
One of the ways bacteria develop resistance is through random mutations that occur when they replicate.
Right.
The faster they grow, the more opportunities there are for those mutations to pop up.
Yeah.
And for a resistant strain to emerge.
So it's like a numbers game.
It is.
The more bacteria there are, the higher the chances of a resistant strain evolving.
Exactly. And by understanding what conditions encourage rapid bacterial growth,
right.
scientists can develop strategies to slow that growth down.
Okay.
This gives our immune systems and the antibiotics a better chance to fight off the infection.
So it's a two-pronged approach.
It is.
We need to control the spread of bacteria and make sure we're using antibiotics wisely.
Precisely. And this knowledge also informs the development of new antibiotics that can target those resistant strains.
This has been a truly eye-opening deep dive into the world of microbiology.
It has.
We've gone from basic lab techniques to the intricacies of bacterial growth, and even explored how this knowledge impacts our everyday lives.
It's incredible how much we can learn from these tiny organisms.
It really is.
And as scientists continue to explore the microbial world, who knows what other fascinating and impactful discoveries await us?
It's a reminder that there's always more to learn.
There is.
And that even the smallest things can have a profound impact on our world.
Absolutely.
Well, that's it for this deep dive.
Thanks for joining us.
We hope you learned something new and exciting.
Yeah.
Remember, curiosity is the key to unlocking a whole universe of knowledge.
It is.
So keep asking questions.
Keep learning.
Keep learning, and we'll see you on our next deep dive.
See you next time.